Well, Merry Christmas Day, Westward Forward listeners, from me, Barry McStay, and from my co-host, Ben Vandeveld. What a treat. We always release our episodes fortnightly on a Monday, and it so happens that it is Christmas Day itself for certain. So you have our annual Best of the Year episode right now in your ears. And having edited it, wow, we've had a lot of fun guests on this year, a lot of really great guests and a lot of really fun episodes. And I've compiled a selection of them here for you. We hope you enjoy. Before you get stuck into that, we've got a shout out to our latest Patreon donor. Thank you very much to Count Dorku. Thank you for helping support the show. Your donations mean an awful lot to us, as indeed everyone's donations on Patreon do. If you can help us out, maybe with a one-off donation, it can just be a once-off to say thanks for everything. Or if you want, you can subscribe and donate monthly. Help keep the lights on, get some bonus content. You get to suggest a topic for an episode if you donate above £5 a month. And lots of other goodies end up on there. Videos of live shows, all sorts. So if you can, join us on patreon.com/worstfootforward. We'd greatly appreciate it. Otherwise, just support us on whatever social media you like. You can find us on Twitter, aka X, or Instagram. We're on @worstfoot on both of those. You can find us on Facebook. You can drop us an email to worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com. And we have a Discord channel. Hey to all our Discord followers. Thank you as ever for being a lovely, kind community to each other. The link to the Discord is in the podcast description. As I said, this is our Best of the Year episode. You're joining us on Christmas Day, a Worst of Forward episode on Christmas Day itself. And you know what that means. We love seeing photos of our listeners sent to us wherever you're listening to the show at this festive time of year. So pop us those on our social media accounts. And as well as thanking all our listeners, thank you to all the guests who've appeared on the show this year, some of whom appear in this episode. Those people appearing in this episode in appearance order are Ed Byrne, Sam C., Carrie Quinlan, Sylvana Vanderveld, Matt Kirshen, Rosie Holt, Queeve O'Donnell, Laura Lex and Ron from Lex Education, John Gracie, Matt Green, Joshua Tonks, Daisy Earl, Rob Manuel, Chris Grace, Ivan Brett, and Johnny Chiodini and Ellie Gibson. We're so grateful to all of you, to all the guests who appear on the show, and to all of you listeners for joining us year in, year out. We're entering what's about to be, I think, is it our 8th year? Holy moly, doesn't time fly? That's a sobering thought, but no sobriety at this time of year. It is Christmas. Pop another cork out of the sherry, have a mince pie, put your feet up, sink into your favourite armchair, and enjoy a cracker of a Best of episode from Worstwood Forward.
What I find that it's interesting is when people use the term moral compass. Everyone always will use it in terms of a compass that points your direction, mm-hmm. and there, as in your morality going towards the right decision. But that's not what a moral compass is. When you use the term moral compass, they're using the mathematical compass that you draw a circle with. That's actually where the term comes from, and then it's what is within that circle is what you deem to be moral, and what is outside that is beyond your moral compass.
Oh, so what's encompassed by your morality?
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah. So everybody uses it. Oh, you know, I think there's a magnet on my moral compass, or you know, my moral compass is pointing the wrong way. Whatever. It's not. That's not the kind of compass that you're. I mean, it works. Moral compass works as a phrase. And there's no reason why you can't say one that points you towards the right decision any more than one that, you know, encircles what is good and leaves out what is bad. But when it was coined as a phrase, moral compass actually referred to the mathematical. That's not one that annoys me. That's not a particularly bad one. It is one that has become misused over time.
Yeah, that's good.
It does draw to mind the idea of Boris Johnson's moral compass. He's just like engraving cocks into his
or you know, or giving his mates a homemade tattoo, you know, where he's just sticking it with his compass in the back of the hand and then pouring fountain pen ink into it.
Tattooing his mates with Boris forever.
But the one I hate which is a new phrase that's come out lately. And I can pinpoint the very first time I heard it was at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival in 2019. So 4 years ago was the first time I ever heard the term Irish goodbye to mean going away without saying goodbye, to leave without saying goodbye. That is apparently an Irish goodbye. And I feel like it stems from a British tendency to label anything that's a bit wrong as Irish.
Yes.
Which they do. I mean, they literally, if you explain something that's a bit backwards or a bit weird, like, oh, that sounds a bit Irish. Is that, are we still doing this? Are we still saying this? Yeah. I mean, you're saying this to me and you can hear my accent. I can only imagine how often you use it other times. So people still use that to describe something that's a bit wrong. But the Irish goodbye, as in to leave without saying goodbye, is, I think, the most inaccurate terminology I've ever heard in my life.
Yeah.
Yeah. Different nations around us get different things, because whether it's accurate or not, you have Irish goodbye, you have French kissing, and you have Dutch courage.
Yes. And I think
I'd like to see Irish kissing, I mean, French courage in the 20th century, non existent. And I'm not quite sure what a Dutch goodbye would be. Probably a Dutch goodbye would be leaving without saying goodbye, because the Dutch are notoriously abrupt and quite rude.
Well, I talk about this in my show, because it's fine, because the Irish absolutely say goodbye. And not only that, like if you were in the pub with my dad and he's leaving, he's saying goodbye to people that he wasn't even there with. Like he's saying goodbye to everybody. If there's other people there that he even vaguely knows, he'll go over to say goodbye to them. And then he'll also say hello and meet the people that they're with and say goodbye to them. So it's a renowned thing of going around and shaking hands. It would be like finding out that the French only kiss with their mouths tightly shut.
Yeah. You know?
But that's the way it is. I mean, I'm not wrong. We have another Irish person here. Testify.
Yeah. Yeah, no, completely. And it's up there with when I first moved to the UK in 2010, I was going for a walk with my husband, my now husband, then boyfriend. And I got annoyed about something, like vaguely sort of jokey annoyed about something. And he jokingly said, "All right, don't throw a paddy." Which was a phrase I had never heard before. And I think it's just in the UK, but it means to have a strop or to like have a tantrum. Mm. And I turned to him in the middle of the embankment guards in Westminster and said, "What the hell did you just say to me?" And his eyes widened. He's like, "Oh, he'd never just like heard what he was saying when he used that phrase until I pointed out to him that it was definitely just going, oh, Irish people are fighty and bad tempered. Mm.
It's such a little one. Yeah, I can't remember. The only thing I can think of is someone turning to me and just going, "Oh, don't throw a yiddy," which would just, it would feel weird, wouldn't it? There's a weird one my mum has, which I've noticed other cultures have. If ever we're running late, my mum will be like, "Oh, we're running on Jewish mean time." Except I talk to Indian friends and they have an idea of Indian time, which is we take ages. And I know loads of black people, particularly Caribbean. Yeah. Well, loads of people talk about black time, which is takes ages. Do we have Irish mean time? Are Irish people prompt or late?
No, the British stole the time from us in the 1800s.
No, you'll get that exact same thing. It's funny, there are certain stereotypes, and I see this a lot, just particularly when you watch stand-up in America, that there's certain stereotypes that it would appear every single race and nation have, apart from basically WASPs, you know, basically if you're not white, but everybody does it. So I've literally seen people go on stage and go, "Yeah, so I'm Italian, so you know, if I don't want to eat a little bit, I gotta say to my mom, I don't want anything, and then she'll just give me a little bit." And then I'd see Greek people do the exact same thing, and black people. So everybody apparently is overfed by their parents, their mother particularly, and it's because of their race that this happens. Everybody apparently except white Protestants.
Which is why those people created empires, because they were starving. They're like, "We need food. We need to go and kidnap your mothers to fill our bread baskets."
Yeah. Obviously, there was also the similar thing to chuck a paddy is the paddy wagon was a reference to, you know, a police van, basically. And some Irish stereotypes are quite curious because they're American. And
I think an Irish goodbye is sort of, It feels like quite an American thing to use as
Well,
well,
I
I
don't
would
know.
say.
I feel it. I maybe just because I was in Britain was the first place I heard it. But I'm thinking the American stereotypes I'm thinking of is particularly that the fighting Irish,
Oh, yeah.
and that whole like leprechaun with his fists up thing. And I mean, obviously I've seen aggro in Ireland, but no more than in England or anywhere else, you know. And I think it's
Yeah.
maybe I don't know if there's something to do with the fact that the Irish that made it to America were big, strong guys. All the weak ones, people like me, just didn't make the crossing. I would have died on the boat. You know what I mean? I would have died on the way over there, and they would have eaten me, right? And so the people who got to the States during famine time, they all became firefighters and police officers because they were all big lads. And so that fighting Irish type of bloke,
And they'd all been radicalized into Fenianism as
Guess,
well.
but I guess
So,
it's an Irish American thing as opposed to an actual Irish thing, you know?
yes, it is very true. Yeah, I read a bit about the Irish goodbye because they across the UK, across Europe and the world, they'll usually say the English or the French to take French leave or to take English leave.
What is the,
It means the
oh,
same
it's to leave
thing.
without saying goodbye.
Is yeah, and I think that some of the first use of French leave, which precedes Irish goodbyes in the 1770s, was when English and French cultures were very interlinked. And it does have that sort of like, it was rude to leave early, so it was a very French thing to do. So again, I think you're sort of right in saying they've sort of co-opted the Irish in whatever the more current nation to sneer at is.
Well,
But in
when did
Germany,
we get branded rude? I always thought we were considered the friendly ones, even by the English.
Yeah.
I think when the IRA started bombing Canary Wharf, I think that
That
probably
is a bit
was
of a
in a
faux
little
pas,
bit
isn't it? You
a
know.
bit gauche.
But
Yeah.
even we phone in warnings, you know, there's still a we still let you know.
Are you suggesting that the IRA had read Debrett? Something like, if you're going to plant a bomb, then it is the correct etiquette to do a warning beforehand.
Yes, exactly. So I mean, if we're warning you that you need to get out of the building, then how is it likely that we won't tell you when we're leaving a building?
Yeah, that's the thing. Whenever I hear news stories about Al Qaeda or ISIS, I just think, oh, manners, 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 boys.
Yeah, they should call it the Al Qaeda goodbye.
Let's deal with the 99 flake right off the bat. It is the most iconic ice cream in the United Kingdom, and understandably, a lot of people are getting grumpy over the past 15 or 20 years that 99 flakes no longer cost 99p. Some of them cost, almost £4, which is a disgrace. But the 99 never referred to its price anyway. And I'd like to assume in the past that it cost a lot less than 99p because that would have been very expensive in the 40s. So there's a number of different theories around it, although the Cadbury's website, which likes to be coy, says that the reason it being called 99 has been lost in the mists of time.
It's not the fucking Rosetta Stone, guys.
Yeah.
What's wrong with you?
So, one claim was that it was coined in Portobello in Edinburgh, where a chap called Stefano Arcari opened a shop at 99 Portobello High Street and would break a flake in half and stick it in the ice cream. So maybe it's from there. Another one comes from another shop in Gorton in Manchester, where there was a sweet shop at 99 Wellington Street. But I like these are the two alternatives. So I spoke before about many immigrant Italian ice cream sellers came from Italy, particularly areas such as Veneto, Trentino, Friuli. And the name was in honor of the final wave of Italian First World War conscripts who will have been born in 1899. And so we're called I Ragazzi del 99, or whatever 99 is in Italian. The Boys of 99, which
Nice.
sounds like a Don McLean song, doesn't it?
It really does,
So
yeah.
they named the ice cream after war veterans?
Well, yeah, pretty much.
Oh, so it's like Calippo just named after Gallipoli? Like, what's you shouldn't talk about the horrors that went down on the fields of Paddle Pop.
I'm just imagining a young Churchill instead of with a cigar, just with a Gallipoli in his.
We shall fight them in the freezers. We shall fight them and the soft serves.
But my favourite one of these sort of classic obituaries that I came across was for the Third Lord Moynihan, which was written in November 1991 by Massingbird's deputy, a chap called David Evans. It begins, "The Third Lord Moynihan, who has died in Manila aged 55, provided, through his character and career, ample ammunition for critics of the hereditary principle."
Yes! I mean, I'm going to say, dying in Manila earlier than your batting average suggests some sort of naughtiness occurring.
It continues, "His chief occupations were bongo drummer, confidence trickster, brothel keeper, drug smuggler, and police informer." And it goes on. It's even, this article I'm reading goes, absurdly it gets better as it goes on. "If there was a guiding principle to Moynihan's life, it was to be found on the wall of his office in Manila, where a brass plaque bore the legend of the 36 ways of avoiding disaster, running away is the best."
That reminds you, there's a comedy promoter called Jonathan Atherton, who died a couple of years ago, and he, I never worked for him, but he did gigs out in that part of the world, in Malaysia and the Philippines and Singapore. And I was reading Matt Kirshen and a couple of other comedians are talking about, they were in after a gig in like a late night eatery, and a guy runs in covered in blood, brandishing a machete. Everyone scarpers and Atherton is just sat there still eating, calm as you like. And you're like, what are you doing? He goes, well, he's not here for me. And just
I did read a bit about Lord Moynihan because he sounds interesting.
Yeah.
He succeeded to the peerage in 1965. His main thrust of interest while in the House of Lords was giving Gibraltar back to Spain. In 1968, he was interrupted giving a speech by Lord Boothby, who said, "My lords, the noble lord has bored us stiff for nearly three quarters of an hour. I beg to move he no longer be heard." In the 1970s, he found employment in the narcotics trade, is how this article describes it.
Confirmed or unconfirmed?
Confirmed, yes. In 1980, he was named by an Australian Royal Commission as an associate of a drug mob in Sydney. He worked as a pimp in the Philippines. He was good friends with President Marcos, who he called my drinking chum.
Uh-huh.
He married an actress and a model called Anne Herbert, and then left her for a Malaysian dancer who danced under the name Princess Amina, reconciled with his first wife, then married the Malaysian dancer after converting to Islam. One of his Malaysian marriages was bigamous, so he also ran nightclubs in Ibiza. He challenged Al Ricketts, an American journalist, to a duel after Al Ricketts criticised his wife's dancing. The duel consisted of them attacking each other with their buttocks.
Oh, sorry, how do you do a...
No idea.
A buttock duel.
Bomb duel.
Bomb duel.
That's an early draft of Hamilton, isn't it? Pretend rules for dueling with your butt.
Is it
running backwards together?
I feel like
does it involve firing?
Does an aide come out with like a mahogany box filled with bums? Gentlemen, choose your bum.
Well, and then you have to, because it's like an old style flintlock blunderbuss, you have to get like the fluffer to prepare it. In my mind, I saw it as kind of like bum sumo wrestling, where you drop your kegs around your knees and you go bum to bum.
Yeah.
Or do you insert a bullet into your arse, which of you farts the most powerfully?
I think that might be it.
Yes.
You wouldn't want to be explaining that to St. Peter. What are you doing here? Well, I have a story for you?
But with Lord Moynihan, it's what he would have wanted.
Yes, exactly what he would have wanted. When he was found out for all of his drug dealing, he eventually turned as an informant for the United States Drug Enforcement Administration. Howard Marks, the famed Welsh drug smuggler, described him as a first-class bastard. What greater tribute could he wish for?
The weird things in VAT or tax is that...
Sylph has just reached behind her and pulled a sheaf of handwritten notes.
I should also point out, we will get a photo for our Instagram. Sylph has also researched this using a law tome that could be used... You should have me holding this, you'd have Sylph holding this. Having a law tome that could easily be used as a weapon.
Yes.
The book one of six.
So what's so bad about VAT?
So VAT, it's complicated and stupid.
Mm. Basically, well, I suppose the sliced bagel thing is one example.
VAT, or sliced bagels is one example. And I'm going to talk about food as well in VAT and how the rules are very odd in that. Now, the basic rule on VAT is when you sell stuff, you have to charge VAT. But then there are exceptions to that rule. And in the 1970s, when VAT was introduced, it was thought that essentials shouldn't be subject to VAT. So essentials are zero rated. So they are technically subject to VAT, but charged at a zero rate. Food is an essential. So technically, food is zero rated. But it doesn't end there. No, you have to look at the principle, everything is subject to VAT. The exception to that, food isn't, but then there's exceptions to that exception. Now, there are further exceptions to that exception. And the reason I have my notes is I had to write down how many exceptions you have to get through to work out how milk is taxed. And milk is the exception to the exception to the exception to the rule.
That is some real Lewis Carroll shit there.
Yeah.
Do you ever regret dedicating your life to this?
I don't do very much VAT, right, which is partly why I'm talking about it today, rather than something that I actually know about.
Please, please tell me that one of the exceptions, the exceptions, the exceptions, the exceptions refers to breast milk. Some horrible Tory minister thinking, going, oh, we can absolutely get in on this action.
It's milk and preparations and extracts thereof.
Jeez.
Oh, I hate that.
would you care for some milk preparation and extracts?
Yeah. Cheese would be exempt under one of the original exceptions. You wouldn't need to get to an exception, to an exception, to an exception, okay, before you get to cheese.
So what is the exception? It's not cubed, is it? Is it? It's to the fourth, to the fifth.
So food is zero rated, but beverages are not zero rated, but milk is zero rated. So. Oh, God. Cheese would just get out by being food.
This has really put me off dairy farming. Don't fancy it.
That was a very simple example, but now I'm gonna.
That was the simple example.
I'm gonna quiz you, and bear in mind the way that things get determined as to whether they are whether you charge VAT on them or not is whether they are essential within food. So,
right.
With that in mind, do you think Jaffa cakes are cakes or biscuits?
Oh, and now,
oh God, we haven't got time.
We have talked about this on the podcast before, and if this is going to be the thing that we all think is true that turns out to not be true, I'm going to be really upset. But I think they're cakes because they're cooked like a cake, and you could expand it to the size of a cake, and it would be a cake. Because they'd be taxed differently, because if they were chocolate biscuit, they'd be a luxury or something like that around them.
Exactly. So food. No VAT, except confectionery, in which there is VAT, except cakes, in which there is no VAT, and biscuits, on which there's no VAT, unless those biscuits are wholly or partly covered in chocolate or a chocolate-like substance, and then there is VAT.
So if they were classed as a chocolate biscuit, they'd be VAT.
Chocolate biscuits, VAT, cake, no VAT. Jaffa cakes are cakes. HMRC always thought that Jaffa cakes were cakes, and then they changed their mind and they decided they were biscuits. And so tried to get some money from McVitie's. McVitie's didn't like that very much and fought it. And this went to court and there was a big court case over it, which decided, basically it came down to the fact that a Jaffa cake, if you leave it out for a while, goes a bit stale and hard, which is what cakes do. Whereas a biscuit, if you leave it out for a while, will go a bit soft. And so because Jaffa cakes go hard, they are cakes. And that, McVitie's...
Stop it, Ben. Stop it. Leave it. Leave it. The listeners are all at home expecting us to do that, and we want to rise above it, no matter how hard it is.
I'm just going to say the quiet bit loud. What you're saying is, stay away from the Jaffa cake erection joke. I just needed to say that order of words
Please,
out loud,
yes.
And now we're done.
And in the end, I landed on, I think, a different definition of worse computer. Because in one sense, this was quite a spectacular computer, but in another sense, this was a really bad computer. Because this was the 18th and 19th century Mechanical Turk. The Turk, yes. Which is an automated chess player. It had a sort of figure of a beturbaned man standing in front of a chessboard and a box underneath, which they would open the doors and show various mechanical gears and cogs and things and moving. And the reason why I think it counts as a terrible computer is because behind all the cogs and machinery, it was just a man in a box. So the big secret of the Mechanical Turk is they had a chess master who would sit inside the box hidden and would play chess against people. And this thing toured the world. It played chess against Napoleon Bonaparte. It played chess against Benjamin Franklin. It would win games. It would demonstrate the knight's tour as well. That was one of its party tricks, which is just using knight moves, touching every square on the chessboard exactly once. And it's, you know, there is a pattern that works. I think there's a couple of patterns that work, but it's hard to learn, hard to memorize, and this machine would do it perfectly. And again, the guy inside the box would just be reading the moves off of a card.
It was basically Mozart and the Mechanical Turk was like touring the courts of Europe.
Yeah, exactly.
That was the cabaret circuit in the 18th century.
and it was very clever, because when I was looking this up, when I was reading about this for the podcast, because I was like, how did no one look inside the box? And they did look inside the box. It actually was constructed like a magic trick. It was constructed like a sort of a magic cabinet from an illusion, where the hiding place for the guy in the box would slide around and move, and the cogs and machinery would also kind of slide into place. So when you open various doors and viewing windows, things would move so that you would never actually see the man. You would always see the cogs and machinery. You could even open two doors opposite each other and see straight through it with cogs in the way. So
that's cool. And then obviously at the end of the game, the Mechanical Turk's keepers would take an enormous broadsword and slam it through the box as well.
I just like the idea of, like, whoever the demonstrator is traveling on a coach across Europe and going, I need two tickets. Sorry, one ticket. One ticket. And the box can just go on the roof.
the logistics behind it is so hard to... Well, yeah, did the chess player have to go on a separate journey? Was it the same chess player every time?
I
don't know, because I also remember being at theme parks as a kid, and every so often at a theme park, there'd be like a little robot or some kind of character that... Do you ever be one that would wheel up to you and would like talk to the kids? And the first thing I'd always do is like look around, and there'd always be like someone who worked for the theme park surreptitiously standing about 10 feet away with like whispering into his hand.
And probably whispering, going, we've got a smart kid. It's just... And then Matt would be whisked away.
They'd bring out the Mechanical Turk to play chess with you instead.
Yeah, I'd just be forced into the box. That's how you get recruited to be the next... You're the robot now.
Yeah. Oh, I mean, I would love to see a movie of a Mechanical Turk and the Santa Claus mashup that you're picturing there. No, the elevator doesn't like it.
Yeah.
down to the car park.
It would be Deep Blue.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it is so interesting that we've, like, wanted for centuries to have a computer beat us at chess.
Yes, and now... Because it also... At first, it was considered, like, a real high mark of intelligence. And now... Yeah, we're now... What, when was Kasparov versus Deep Blue? That was around... was it 20 years ago?
97.
Yeah. Oh, God. Yeah. You know what? This is me being old now, where I think 96, 97 is 20 years ago, but it's actually... It's 2.5 decades ago now. In fact, more. It's getting close to 3 decades ago. But in the time since... Now, the best chess grandmaster can't even come close to beating an average desktop computer.
This reminds me of far and away my favorite Emo Phillips joke, which is my computer beat me at chess, but it was no match for me at kickboxing.
Yeah, I always think Mike Tyson would be the greatest chess boxer of all time if they always started with the boxing.
Tyson,
we have to make it happen.
I did go in a bit of a Wikipedia hole a while back on chess boxing, and they won't let you do it unless you're of a certain standard of boxing, at least. Like, there's a minimum level. Because, yeah, I was wondering about that, of just sort of how good a chess player... Like, could Magnus Carlsen win at chess boxing by finishing the game of chess before he had to throw a punch?
I think that boxing would be more interesting if they had a chess clock that you had to tap every time you'd punch the other person.
Yeah, you each get it. And you each have to think about what punch you're going to do. It's
yeah,
just like...
yeah.
Fist to D4, and yes. Then you go to the chin.
Yeah, we're so far beyond chess being... I think Go now, which was the big board game that was considered... for a long time, humans were absolutely dominant over computers because there's so many variables in Go. It's really hard for computers to do what they do, which is to investigate all of the different possibilities quickly. Because unlike chess, where you have at most 16 pieces that you could theoretically move, and each of them has a limited number of places. I think Go is like a 13x13 grid, and you can put your piece anywhere on it, so yeah. There are just so many more variables, so it really, the number of
computers have beaten us at Go now. They have destroyed the grandmasters,
yeah. Yeah. And that's the thing, yeah, the tree of potential moves grows so quickly in Go. It was thought to be incredibly hard for computers, but now no, they've, with machine learning and better algorithms and better computers.
Can they beat us at Guess Who is the question.
Hang on, but computer Guess Who is called CCTV. And yes, they can.
Yeah. Yep, it's already like, no, you can't come into this football match. You said something mean about the chairman on a... We've identified you from your Instagram pictures.
From your hat and your beard and your glasses.
Yeah.
So the Turk... It was wildly popular for ages, and then I vaguely remember like it sort of ended up in a museum somewhere, or like it sort of disappeared and reappeared and fell into.
Yeah, and there have been reconstructions of it. So some guy in a magician's manufacturer, his name is John Gaughan, or Gaughan, and he spent over $100,000 building his own version in the '80s. And it uses the original chessboard that was stored separately from the original Turk and not destroyed in the fire, which destroyed the original one. So it was a fire that started at the National Theatre in Philadelphia, and it reached the museum where it was stored, and it destroyed the Mechanical Turk.
And the screams of the man inside it.
Yeah. So supposedly, John Kersley Mitchell, who bought it and put it in the museum, claimed that he heard through the struggling flames the last words, quote, of our departed friend, the sternly whispered, oft-repeated syllables, echek, echek, which is what the Turk would say when he got someone in check.
Rosie, we've learned that you're very good at fooling all sides of the political debate. What are you not so good at?
I find it incredibly hard to learn dance moves. And obviously, I don't want to look too far ahead or presume, but sometimes I worry, what happens if I get asked to do Strictly Come Dancing? What will I do?
You will become the nation's sweetheart.
It'll be a genuine worry.
You do it. You do it, you learn, or you don't learn, and you become viral in a different way.
No, and it will be, I just remember watching, do you remember Rachel Riley?
Yes.
Did it.
Yeah.
And I felt so sorry for her, because you could tell she was really trying, and then... Week after week, they'd just be like, oh, you're so terrible, you're bad, whatever. And I thought that would be me, but worse. I once did a dance class, and the teacher, she went, okay, stop the class. She gets to me, she went, you do it like this? She was doing it, and she was showing me. And then she ended up going, no, I can't do this. Someone needs to show her after the class. I can't do it.
You're the teacher.
She couldn't deal with me.
Oh wow! You broke.
Can't learn them at all. I went. It was a miserable class because I went to drama school, and it was always miserable. My dance classes, because I had no idea what was going on.
Oh,
I would
do
end
you know
up
what,
dancing though? Into the wall.
I would pay to watch. I would personally vote week after week to keep you in to watch you break Giovanni Pernici's brain. Because they're locked in a room with you. They can't be that teacher who goes, I have another class in an hour. They're with you for 12 hours a day, every day, every week.
Oh my God.
But you're important. You're the control contestant. Like,
yeah.
I've seen someone talk about this on Twitter, and I agree that every Olympic track and field event, they should have just a normal guy also racing, so you realise how impressive these athletes are. Like Usain Bolt bombing down the 100 metres in 9.5 seconds, and then me puffing behind him at about 25. Yeah. You're that to the dance world.
Yeah, that's nice. I like that.
Yeah. They just have a little box at the corner of the screen, which is, and this is how Rosie is doing.
You still struggling to get out of the dance studio. Just can't even manage that.
My favourite headline is Florida man arrested for public sex with a dog and ruined church nativity. Now that is a day out.
Which role was he playing?
It's a real dog. The dog in a manger, God bless him, is really struggling.
I mean,
right.
Like that dog doesn't want to live forever. That dog's lived too long as it is.
I think what's happened with Florida is, like, you'll both know from when you're writing, you've got your main document where you write your first drafts, and then you've got sort of the offcuts bin of stuff that's either not ready or too weird and can't put in the main body of text. Florida is God's offcuts bin. It's where he puts all of the stuff too implausible for the rest of reality.
And the weird thing, you know, because this is the thing that I'm sure everyone's done, where Google your date of birth and Google Florida man and see what the weird story is like. And that you still will have a selection of to do for that. I think one of my favourite ones was an old lady in a retirement home was arrested for felony assault with an avocado. Like the weapon was an avocado that she assaulted somebody with.
I have just done the McDonnell algorithm, and on May the 14th, 2019, we have from Fox News, Florida man reportedly tells cops he thought playing basketball naked would enhance his skill level.
I've literally just Googled the phrase naked Florida man. And naked Florida man tells police he is from different Earth.
Oh, yeah. That's that guy. Yeah, I've seen that one. There's a few of them, to be fair. Because I saw that and I went, was that happened? Yeah, that's happened several times though. Because I looked up, I've seen that before. I went, oh no, this is a different guy. Yeah. And I genuinely, I'd love to. We have to get those two guys together to see if they come from the same Earth. That would be an amazing Earth thing.
Yes, this is just for balance issue. This is a gift that keeps on giving. On another May the 14th, Florida man gets into a fight with a tree. Just an endless tombola of ramshackle crime.
Machete-wielding naked Florida man attacked mailboxes.
Yeah, actually, weirdly, a combination of those two. I did see a bloke, a drunk bloke in Manchester, try and fight a dustbin. I remember trying to do it as a stand-up and no one believed it, but it did. I just saw a drunk bloke bang into a dustbin outside my flat, and then he tried to kick it, missed, and then he got up and started trying to punch the thing because he was so angry at it. And, like, the bin won the fight by a mile. That guy limped off with a bloody hand. But yeah, mine, because I've actually redone mine. Florida, I'm going to click mine. Florida man accused of grabbing his genitalia and giving finger to a man and his 8-year-old son. Classy. Arrested for giving girlfriend wet willy. Florida man Vladimir Putin arrested on trespassing charges. I think that because that made it in just like it's out. No, not that one. I presume he changed his name to be Vladimir Putin. Oh, wow, he's a black dude. Did not see that coming.
It is literally like you've gone to one of these ChatGPT generator headline things, but they're all really genuine headlines.
I'm trying to work out where on the ascent of man Florida man comes, like between like Homo erectus, Homo habilis and Homo sapiens. Yeah. Like, I worry it's after sapiens and we're just going downhill.
Yeah. Naked Florida man steals flag from yacht here.
Oh yeah, naked Florida man does everything. I mean, if you can find, honestly, for a person who literally follows a couple of accounts to report these things, if you can find stories where they're actually wearing clothes, you'll be doing well. Naked man is very popular. Naked man attacks strip club with alligator, which is like, I think in that one he threw the alligator on top of the roof of the strip club, which just gave more questions. Like, was he trying to get the alligator in there? Was it they stopped him coming in with the alligator, and that's what he's trying to get the? There's so many questions as to what led up to that.
I thought you were going to say he threw it onto the stage, like as if he was tipping.
Yeah,
make it rain, alligators.
Just, I've never done this. I'm going to Google Florida alligator strip club. I guarantee you, someone will have thrown an alligator onto a strip club. Okay, there's a gator club, which has, I've found,
First thing comes up, TripAdvisor. That's a weird one.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Florida man tries to smuggle alligator into strip club. So there we go.
Was it the alligator stag do? Like, what the fuck?
Well, obviously, when alligators go on holiday, they take inflatable humans to ride.
Yes,
the pool.
Of course they do.
He was trying to bring the alligator in because he was, quote, his good luck charm. I mean, bless the naivety of the man who thinks you need luck in a strip club. Because, you know, the girls really like me. Well, sorry, no. This is ultimate Florida gun, man. This is in the third paragraph. I would have led with this. But the real shocker came when the alligator was searched by police and found to be carrying a fully loaded handgun in its mouth. Ladies and gentlemen, we have ultimate Florida man moment.
That is magnificent.
When questioned about the weapon, Billy Bob, who describes himself as the redneck genius, was asked about it. He said he shrugged and stated, "Gator ain't got no pockets, now does he?" Which, to be fair, he doesn't. That's, again, completely correct.
I'm staggered by that. I really am. That's incredible.
I'm losing my mind.
Ron, what have you brought to us for the world's worst siblings?
So I saw some of the research that Laura was doing, and I wanted to go down a slightly different, non-sort of murdery, incesty kind of vibe. So I bring it to the table, John Attenborough.
Oh, the
one locked in the attic.
Oh no, the Zeppo of the Attenborough brothers.
Yeah, so you've got obviously David, world-renowned naturalist, voice of the nation, national treasure. Then you've got Richard, Jurassic Park. And then John is
Richard, Jurassic Park, odd parents, but ultimately normative determinism won out.
Yeah, the greatest scientist of our age. In that, I heard a great fan theory about Jurassic Park that the two children in it, they are actually grown in the same way the dinosaurs are in the lab, and because you don't see their parents. I don't know if they ever actually refer to them, and they've just been grown and made by Richard Attenborough. No, we're not buying it. Fair enough.
But John Attenborough was only the head of Alfa Romeo in the UK, CEO for UK operations. But...
That's what a failure. So he's a businessman, presumably, and that was one of
his titan of industry, but still the failure. Still.
Was he oldest, youngest?
Youngest, yeah. Grew up in their shadow. Rose as high as he could.
That's there's something nice about the fact that Alfa Romeos famously look good but are absolute dog shit to drive. Finally, which sort of fits the niche of where he's ended up.
Yeah, it's not dinosaurs or real animals. It's just.
It also must have been awkward as arse to be like the director of a motor car company when your brother is one of the most famous voices against climate. Oh my God. Awkward.
Yeah, and your other brother, like, created a fictional park whose inhabitants will eventually die and turn into the fuel for your car.
Did they have any other siblings? It was just the three of them?
No, just the three of them. No other scapegoats. He was categorically the worst Attenborough.
I also, I've not got a picture of him, but I love, and please do this after the show, I love looking at pictures of brothers or sisters of famous people, particularly good-looking people. Look at Brad Pitt's brother. He looks, if you didn't know Brad Pitt existed, you'd be like, that's a good-looking man. But because you know Brad Pitt exists, you're like, oh, they made Brad Pitt wrong. It's like someone tried to construct Brad Pitt from memory. I've just looked
up his Wikipedia, and Richard and David would come up with Sir David Attenborough or Sir Richard. Oh. It's just John Attenborough. He didn't even get a knighthood. What a failure. This loser. And to any other people on the outside, you'd be like, what an overachieving family.
Yeah.
On the inside, John, scarred by his brother's achievements.
And also, like, because David Attenborough is one of the 65 companions of honour, isn't he? The king or queen's besties, where I imagine...
Do you imagine he goes over and, like, braids Charles's hair and they watch films together and talk about girls? It's like your professional best friend.
Yeah,
much like you and I.
Ow! Yes, I imagine that's absolutely what he does. Are you the only two siblings? Or have
no.
You got...
No, we've got two shit ones as well.
Oh! Cool. And which car company are they executives of?
They're like good people that are helping raise the next generation, you know, by being selfless teachers. Chumps.
Ron's being a selfless teacher. He's just got a dreadful pupil.
I love that you've just taken his word for it. I'm a dreadful pupil.
Yeah, I'm not selfless.
You're just in it for the money.
Okay.
In it for the money. The podcast money.
A princely £25 a month.
Very good.
Oh, cool. So, yeah. So, suggestion number one from the Lex Education team is John Attenborough, a man with a surname you'd notice, but a face you would walk past in the street. And,
Peter Stump, born in around 1530, and in 1589, so he's 59 at this point. And bear in mind, this is after being stretched out on the rack, which I have a feeling I would say anything if I was stretched out on the rack. You know, have you seen... the famous like Guy Fawkes signature that when you studied history at school, where you like see his handwriting pre-torture and then afterwards, and it's like, this is a man that didn't have a choice about what he signed.
No,
whether he did it or not, it's kind of like,
actually, that signature was done by my 5-year-old son. That's just all that happened there. It's not it's not a man who's been tortured. Yeah. It's just a preschooler.
So anyway, he was stretched on the rack and confessed all this stuff afterwards. So take that for what you will. But he confessed to having practiced black magic since he was 12. And crucially, this is interesting in terms of how transformations happen. He claimed that the way he was able to transform into a wolf was because he was given a belt by the devil, a girdle or a belt. And when he put it on, he would transform into a wolf-like creature. There's a great quote here. So, the devil, he claimed the devil had given him a magical belt which enabled him to metamorphose into, quote, the likeness of a greedy, devouring wolf, strong and mighty, with eyes great and large, which in the night sparkled like fire, a mouth great and wide, with most sharp and cruel teeth, a huge body and mighty paws.
Sexy.
And so, pretty hot, right? You can see where the sexy stuff comes from.
Yeah.
And so he claims that when he removed the belt, he would transform back into his human form. And he did tell the local magistrate where he'd left the belt, in a certain valley, is the quote, but they couldn't find it. So, you know, read into that what you will. But his alleged crimes were 25 years of being, quote, an insatiable bloodsucker, gorged on the flesh of animals and humans. And this is where it gets really grim. So just if you don't like hearing about really bad things, I would suggest stopping listening. This was after he was threatened with torture, but he confessed, whether this is true or not, he confessed to eating 14 children.
Uh-oh.
This is really bad. I'm not going to go. It's too bad. I'm reading it out now. It's awful. It's really horrible, which is why I say worst in terms of ethically worst, as opposed to not very good. He also ate his son, apparently, and he was accused of having an incestuous relationship with his daughter, who was, according to the laws at the time, sentenced to die with him, because it was her fault, apparently. And he also confessed to fucking a succubus, sent him by the devil. So, you know, maybe this is true, maybe not.
I'm enjoying that you're keeping your mind open on this.
I'm just like, if ever anyone confesses to a thing after torture, I'm just like, how much is any of this true? But also, you know, maybe there were loads of deaths and it was really obviously this guy. He was executed on Halloween night, as in October... is it 31st or 30th Halloween?
It's the 31st.
31st. It's a bit on the nose, that, executing him on Halloween, though, isn't it?
I know. How cool is that, though? Halloween night, 1589.
Trick or treat.
Yeah. He was executed alongside his daughter, which is really rough, because she didn't fucking do anything. And his mistress, Catherine. We don't know what she did, but they were executed. And the torture was one of the most brutal on record. Are you familiar with the wheel as a torture device?
Vaguely.
Yeah. Yeah, essentially, they get a big, like, wagon wheel and just, like, continually drop it on you to, like, break your bones. The idea being to injure you but not kill you. And then when you're kind of mangled up, from what I can tell, they kind of, like, weave you through the, like, spokes of the wheel, which is just grisly.
No thanks.
He was put to the wheel, and then the flesh was torn from his body in 10 places by red-hot pincers, and then torn from his arms and legs. His limbs were broken to prevent him coming back from the dead before he was beheaded and then burned on a pyre. So they really, like, they really wanted to make sure with this guy.
They weren't taking any chances. Like,
yeah.
The funny thing, the thing that always gets me with these is that, how I turn into a werewolf is I have a magic belt. Well, why don't we destroy the magic belt and not? Why don't we put the magic belt on the rack? Or the other thing is, you know, they intermittently turn into werewolves. So why don't we lock them up for long enough to see if that's true? And if they don't turn into a werewolf, then great, we let them
go again.
It's
very provable, doesn't it?
Yeah. But then again, I'm bringing reason to a knife fight, so...
Yeah, exactly.
You're bringing reason to a werewolf trial.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm very sad to say his daughter and mistress were killed as well, which is fucking rough, because they didn't seem to be involved at all. Yeah. But as a warning against similar behaviour, local authorities erected a pole with the torture wheel and the figure of Wolf on it, and at the very top they placed Peter Stump's severed head.
Oh, so they
really went to town on this guy.
But honestly, the people in the past, they were just like us. They weren't superstitious. They weren't carried away by the madness of crowds.
It was just all about community, wasn't it?
We've just got to remember that it was a different time. We can't place our modern value judgments on.
Yeah. Which of us wouldn't have racked someone to a wheel and then slid their body through it? That's the werewolf of Bedburg. So I wonder if he even did any of it, to be honest, based on how spurious all of this is. But also maybe it was really obviously him, and so they went to town on him, because if you were there, you were like, yeah, this dude's really creepy and he's got blood all over him, let's get him.
All I'm saying is, broadly speaking, this is awful and barbarous and I do not approve, but if for one night only we wanted to bring back The Wheel as a primetime BBC One entertainment starring Russell Brand,
Michael McIntyre hosted at the moment.
Oh, God, yeah.
That's what I assumed that show was. He got various celebrities and saw how long they could last under torture of spending time with Michael McIntyre.
Yeah, while still answering trivia questions.
Yes.
But also, very occasionally, you might fall off the wheel, like if your body just kind of slithers down, and that was seen as God granting you reprieve, and then you would be released. Like you would be seen.
So they actually,
like kind of surviving drowning as a witch.
They actually did let you get away. Like,
it was interpreted as God's intervention. there exist votive images. I don't know what votive images are.
Like little prayer icons.
Right. Votive images of saved victims of the wheel, and there is literature on how best to treat such sustained injuries. I mean, I don't know how you're treating those injuries of all those broken limbs.
Imagine being the person who, at the end of like torturing you with the wheel, and then God intercedes, you're the one who has to go and go, oh, sorry about that. Here's some literature on how to make yourself feel better.
You're all right. Yeah.
Yes. Sorry that 90% of the bones in your body are broken. Here's a pamphlet.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you've been smashed on the wheel.
This is a campaign to get Danish, the Danish youth vote out. It is incredible. So it was for the 2014 European parliamentary elections, and the Danish parliament created a cartoon featuring the muscle-bound bruiser Votemann. And it's very Rick and Morty, I'd say, is the vibe of it. And it features Votemann having an orgy with several women. Several women. Yes, one woman wearing different masks.
That's a different character.
My
name is Several Woman. I am all women.
Presumably, she thought that he'd said, "Put your tick in my box."
Oh, very nice.
Hello.
But it's all about how, as a young man, he regretted not voting and you know, spending all of his time like living life to the full. But now, and he sort of...
Oh, no, I wish I'd voted. Yeah. I wouldn't have had all this sex with all these women.
It's a ridiculous campaign. And he sort of turns himself into this weird, oversexed Johnny Bravo character, punching people into booths with his fists and his belly.
Have you never been to a polling booth? That's what they're all like.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it's pretty insane.
It's like Weimar Berlin in there. that is the worst possible comparison to make, given what we're talking about. It is astonishing. And obviously, it was taken down very quickly. And the chair of the Danish parliament, Mogens Lichtoft, said, many, whose views I deeply respect, found the EU Information Centre's cartoon to be much more damaging and offensive than it was intended to be. And felt it talked down to young people.
The thing I love about that is they've gone, oh, young people, we must do them a cartoon. You have to be 18 and over to vote.
Yeah. They're trying to build the expectation. They want 10-year-olds to be going, Mummy, when can I vote? Not now, dear. Not yet.
Yes.
Soon. And when you vote, oh boy, what fun you'll have.
But none of those confusing names are my worst candy. Instead, I've gone for another
traditional American candy bar, the Baby Ruth.
Ah, yes. Okay.
Now, Josh, you spent quite a lot of time in America. Have you had a Baby Ruth?
I've not, actually. I know of them, but I've not had one.
Who do you think it's named after?
Now, is this a red herring or is it the baseball guy?
Yes, it is a complete red herring. You might imagine it is named after Babe Ruth, the baseball player.
Baby Jane. Maybe it's the baby.
It's both. It's a Baby Ruth. The Curtis Candy Company claimed, when they released it in 1921, that they had named their candy bar after the daughter of the American president, Grover Cleveland, Ruth, who had died quite young. This was released in 1921. Ruth had died 17 years previously.
Oh.
24 years previously, Cleveland had left the White House. Coincidentally, in 1921, the famous baseball player Babe Ruth's career was just beginning to take off. But Babe Ruth had a tie-in with another company to manufacture a Babe Ruth-approved chocolate bar.
Wow.
So the Curtis Candy Company had not negotiated an endorsement deal with Ruth. And basically, this seems like they had gone, well, he's the most famous person in America, basically, at the moment. Let's make a chocolate bar that piggybacks on his success without having to go through the rigmarole of convincing him to endorse our product. It seems like they came up with this idea of naming it after Baby Ruth Cleveland.
What a spin.
Can you imagine the meetings where they go, listen, we're going to have to market this. It can either be famous baseball player or dead presidential baby.
Those are the only two options.
Yeah.
That meeting got adjourned pretty quickly.
Who do we have to pay? Okay, yeah. We'll do the other one.
So there's a book called Imponderables by David Feldman, and he writes, the trademark was patterned exactly after the engraved lettering of the name used on a medallion struck for the Chicago World's Columbian Exposition in 1893, picturing the president, his wife, and daughter Baby Ruth. So the actual writing on the chocolate bar looks like the writing on this medal to celebrate Baby Ruth's birth. Suggestion is, again, that they thought they'd use that as cover for what they were up to. And in another book, Tom Burnham, he suggests that the candy bar was named after the granddaughter of Mr. and Mrs. George Williamson, who'd sold the original formula to the Curtis Company. That seems unlikely. Even Snopes, the famous debunking website, have weighed in on this. They've denied the idea that it was the granddaughter of the Williamsons, saying that the Baby Ruth bar came about when Otto Schnering, the founder of the Curtis Candy Company, made some alterations to his company's first candy offering, a confection known as Candy Cake, and rebranded it. It looks a bit like a Snickers bar or a Lion
right.
bar.
What's it taste like?
Bite into it. Chocolate and shit. Peanuts and caramel. Yeah. But the Baby Ruth bar took off in quite a big way, in more ways than one, as you'll come to learn. In 1929, the Curtis Candy Company sponsored the Baby Ruth Hour, a CBS radio program. And for a company that protested that they hadn't named their chocolate bar after Babe Ruth, in 1932, Babe Ruth famously called a shot. This is a lot of American sports fans will be aware of this. The story goes that he pointed out over the bleachers and then smashed a ball over the bleachers for a home run, and it was to help his team win the World Series in 1932. And in the aftermath of that match was played at Wrigley Field in Chicago. The Curtis Company installed an illuminated advertising sign for the Baby Ruth chocolate bar on the roof of a flat across the road, in line with where that shot had been hit. And it stood for four decades.
Oh,
shots
God.
Of Wrigley Field until the 70s had this sign in the background. And again, this company had denied it was anything to do with Babe Ruth. In 1985, Nabisco had bought the bar by then. They paid $100,000 for product placement for Baby Ruth to appear in The Goonies. In 1995, a company representing Babe Ruth's estate licensed his name and likeness for a Baby Ruth marketing campaign. In 2007, in an edition of the Chicago Cubs game program, there's a full-page ad for Baby Ruth's with the slogan, the official candy bar of Major League Baseball and proud sponsor of the Chicago Cubs. And the same season, they had a TV ad for Baby Ruth's where they had an entire stadium filled with people who were eating Baby Ruth's. So instead of being able to sing, they were humming Take Me Out to the Ball Game. But definitely they did not name this bar after Babe Ruth.
Oh no, absolutely. Just a coincidence. All coincidences.
And if you think that's bad enough, if you think naming a bar in a mercenary way is a meager excuse for it being the worst candy on earth, I offer you this addendum. Otto Schnering chartered a plane in 1923 to drop thousands of Baby Ruth chocolate bars over the city of Pittsburgh to help promote the chocolate bar. Now, he was clever enough to give each chocolate bar its own parachute. So there wasn't what you'd imagine, maybe hundreds of kids having their eyes taken out and by airdropped chocolate bars.
Yeah.
In fact, the Pittsburgh stunt was such a success that over the next 6 years, Schnering had parachute drops of Baby Ruth chocolate bars performed over cities across the USA in 40 different states, as I say, for 6 years, until the Depression kicked in and throwing away chocolate bars was probably deemed a bit unseemly. One of these candy drops took place in Florida in 1927. Now, attending this was a young kid called Paul Tibbetts. Paul Tibbetts had moved with his family, his dad, Paul Warfield Tibbetts Sr., and his wife, Enola Gay Tibbetts. When he was 8, they moved to Florida to escape the Midwestern winters of Illinois, and he was very interested in flying, and his mother agreed to pay a dollar to get him into an airplane at a local carnival. And in 1927, that airplane happened to be the one that was going to be flown by a barnstormer, an aviation sort of trick performer, called Doug Davis, and his job that day was to drop Baby Ruth candy bars with tiny parachutes to the crowd attending the horse races at Hiley Park Racetrack in Florida. 12-year-old Paul was so taken by this that he took up a career in aviation. He became so experienced that he actually rose to the rank of Air Force Colonel in the United States Air Force. And you might remember that I said his mother's name was Enola Gay. And Paul, when he was given control of a B-29 Super Fortress, he named it in honour of his mother. The Enola Gay had her name printed on the nose cone. And a couple of days later, in August 1945, Paul Tibbetts, inspired by his flight on a Baby Ruth plane, was the man in command of the fighter plane that dropped the first atomic bomb on Hiroshima in Japan in 1945.
Oh,
so I put it to you that the Baby Ruth chocolate bar gave us the death of 60,000 Japanese people.
To Alaska and to the Igloo City. And if you were travelling in between the two major cities in Alaska, which are Fairbanks and Anchorage, halfway between, you would find this bizarre looking 4-story concrete structure that looks like someone tried to build a Cold War military igloo.
I've just googled it. It looks so sad.
It's really, really sad. So it was built by a chap called Leon Smith, and his life story really fits with this podcast. He was born in Missouri in 1921. He fought in World War II against the Japanese. He captained a tugboat in California, and then he became a deep sea fisherman and lumberjack, and that work took him to Alaska's interior. He was a devoted man of the woods, you know, proper outdoorsman. And him and his wife opened a gas station at milepost 188.5, which is halfway between Anchorage and Fairbanks. And he looked around and he thought, do you know what? I'm going to build a hotel here. We'll turn this nowhere into a somewhere. And he had this grand vision for the Igloo Lodge. There'd be guest rooms and a restaurant and a bar and a liquor store and a fourth floor penthouse suite. And so he cleared the land behind his gas pumps and he started building it. And he hoped for a grand opening in 1973. By 1991, it was still being built. And right. When interviewed by a journalist for the Star Tribune newspaper, he basically said, anytime I get together enough money, I build another room. And brilliantly, when he was asked why, now at the age of 70 years old, he had dedicated decades of his life to building an igloo hotel in the middle of Alaska, he answered, well, you wouldn't put an igloo hotel in Kansas or Egypt, would you?
I love that sassy
answer. Right?
An igloo hotel has to exist, so I'm going to put it in the logical place.
Yep.
Yeah.
5 years later, you know, he was 75, his health was failing, and he had to try and find a way to provide for his wife after he passed away. And so he reached out to a chap called Brad Fisher and tried to get him to buy the plot of land. Smith made, by his own admission, a paltry offer, assuming that Leon Smith would refuse. He didn't. And so in 1996, the Igloo Lodge changed hands. And Brad Fisher was determined to finish the job as a tribute to Leon Smith. But money was tight. And by 2005, he had to close the gas station and close the site. He said it was really frustrating because people would come along to this place and just use it to
take a dump, do a wee, or kids would come by and set off fireworks inside it. At one point, someone stole the entire staircase. And so it got declared by the state as, in their words, an attractive nuisance. It even got to a stage that local grizzly bears started to use it as their local, I'd say, hideout.
This is my favourite part of the story. But this is meant to be, hang on, this is meant to be the worst hotel.
Yes.
A hotel that bears took over and made their hideout is, I think, the best hotel in the world.
I love the sound of the fact that humans were taking shits in the hotel and then the bears are like, oh, we've been doing it wrong all these years.
Yeah. I deliberately took out a piece of this where someone accidentally ran onto a bear on the site, was picked up by the bear's jaws with its head, his head in their jaws, threw him about, and he had to crawl to the nearest bit of safety. And his first question was, do I still have my ears? And the guy had to have 1,000 stitches.
4 stars on TripAdvisor. That'd knock a star off.
It really will. Apparently, according to Brad Fisher, the brush around here is so thick, it's really risky. You could walk right into the back of a bear and not even know it.
Oh my gosh. Bears are so much less fun when you really think about them.
Yeah.
Because I'm still picturing, like, Yogi. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
As of the last article I could find was from about 4 or 5 years ago. As of then, this structure required millions of dollars of investment to make it work. But it was on sale for $300,000. And for that, you could buy a steadily decaying 4-story igloo-shaped urine-soaked structure full of bears.
What's $300,000 in UK money?
Probably about £280,000. What, do you want to start a Kickstarter?
But the thing is, you could probably, I reckon we could afford that between us. Do you mean, could you get a mortgage on it, or you got to buy it outright?
Do you know what? I've not looked into the finances, to be honest, Daisy.
We'd be looking to diversify our portfolio.
Yeah, but if you mean people crowdfund all kinds of stupid stuff, I think a bear hotel, and then you could send Instagram people there, and you're going to get great content. I just think, got to think outside the box here, lads, do we?
We could get those people they sent to that Shine factory, that story that's been going around. This. We're recording this in the week that a few influencers were sent to the company Shine's, definitely not sweatshops, to promote them. Oh. We could get them to go to the bear hotel. Actually, guys, it's not so bad. I've only had like one limb ripped off. Go and make up your own mind about these things. Don't believe the mainstream media about the alleged bear hotel.
But it has to be those exact influencers. Yes, the ones that went to justify a sweatshop. Yeah. They have to now go to Bear Hotel, for sure.
My choice for the world's worst pop star. I've gone for the Syrian pop star, Mayada Beseles, for a political campaign song.
Oh, no.
Saddam Hussein, running for the presidency of Iraq. I say running, it was very much strolling in most cases. But 2002, the heat is on a little bit in Iraq at this point, shall we say. And so he thought, you know, actually, maybe I need to, you know, put at least a sort of a gloss of democracy in it, make it look like I'm having to try to be elected for another 7-year term. And so Saddam Hussein decided, you know, I need to go full-blown political campaign. There was literally no one else running for president, but he wanted to the outside world to make it look like he was popular and there was democracy in Iraq. So he toured the country, he gave speeches, he held rallies, he kissed babies, all of that stuff. He had supporters with badges and there were signs and there would be cheering. And, you know, borrowing a little bit from Western campaigning, he thought he'd have a bit of pop music. And so he thought, what song will tell the people looking into Iraq that I am a beloved leader of my country? And he opted for I Will Always Love You. the 1973 hit by Dolly Parton, most famously recorded by Whitney Houston in 1992 in the soundtrack for The Bodyguard, of which Saddam had many. But he had this Syrian pop star, Mayada Beseles, record it in Arabic for his campaign stops. And, you know, it was getting close to election day. It was being played relentlessly on TV. On...
I'm just humming.
He could have gone with "I want you bath for good," I suppose, as well.
Oh my god,
he tried harder. But it was very effective, it turns out, because sure enough, October
100% of the vote.
100% of the vote.
Barry, correlation is not necessarily.
He got every one of the 11.4 million registered voters out to vote in his. They had 100% turnout, so, and 100% of the vote.
And Brittany was not playing that night.
Brittany wasn't playing, yeah. He was, of course, as we probably remember, out of a job less than 6 months later. But yeah, I've gone for Syrian pop star Mayada Baselas' cover of I Will Always
Love You. But so they're the worst pop star because they agreed to do this bullshit.
I think there's also that aspect of, you know, the Dolly Parton version is good. Whitney Houston version is the peak of that song. I think Mayada Baselas' version is very much the Godfather 3 in this trilogy.
No, but
have you dug it out to give it a listen?
I could not find it, but I very much know the tune.
But do you know it in Arabic? Does it? I wonder whether it scans.
Yes, that's also a very good question. That is as far as my research has gone, that a Syrian pop star recording a cover of I Will Always Love You for Saddam Hussein's re-election campaign.
I mean, top work, because when you opened with politics, I thought, oh God, did Adolf Hitler have a campaign song? And then when he went to Syria, I was like, oh my God, is Bashar al-Assad working with Eiffel 65?
ISIS 65.
There we are. Also want to tell you about the story of Dusan Sestic, who is, oh, poor guy. He's had quite a journey, but also he's made some poor choices. So in 1998, there was a contest to write a new Bosnian national anthem for reasons that we're not going to go into, because comedy podcast, lads. Comedy podcast. And a chap called Dusan Sestic entered. Now, he didn't really want to win it for a couple of reasons. One, he was more nostalgic for the previous country of Yugoslavia, of which Bosnia had been a part of. And also, he was from the neighbouring country of Serbia. And when he won it, some fellow Serbs, who, I don't know if you know, guys, they are generally very well-tempered, understanding, moderate people, got pretty angry at Sestic and labelled him a traitor. And when a Serb... brands you a traitor, it is best to say, you know what, mate, you take whatever vaccinations you do or don't want, and that last shot was in. But what's brilliant is Sestic just doesn't know when to let go, because a decade later he won another contest to write lyrics to the anthem. I don't know why they decided they needed a decade in between. And even though he won it, the politicians didn't approve of the lyrics, and so he never was paid the €15,000 in winnings. But
of course they did.
The worst bit for him is that he was accused of plagiarism for the tune. Now listen, we've said before, different nations sort of steal different tunes from each other, or maybe from the worlds of opera or classical music. Not our friend Dusan. Unbeknownst to him, he had lifted the melody from the 1979 National Lampoon movie Animal House.
Oh gosh. Which song?
So are we saying Chevy Chase has wrote the anthem of Bosnia?
It is the bit in the opening. I haven't done my research on this, which is very poor of me, but it's corroborated by several articles.
He's so good.
He responded beautifully, saying, there is some difference between the two melodies, and in his words, not everyone in this country is a thief or corrupt. If I was, I would be a politician and be doing far better in life.
Okay, I just want to make sure that it wasn't the shout song from Animal House.
No. It's like, yeah. I think it's the Animal House. That one.
Well, because the Bosnian one is one of the ones that still doesn't have lyrics now, so it's just his tune, presumably, that he stole.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
It wouldn't be the first anthem to come from a film, because the Chinese national anthem, March of the Volunteers, was originally composed for a 1935 film called Children of Troubled Times. Huh. It was a love story set during the Japanese invasion of Manchuria, and the song was so popular, it became the national anthem in
1949. Oh. By the way, that Bosnian national anthem actually was plagiarized, originally written by Ed Sheeran.
It's just chords. It just happens. Just happens to be like that.
It's just, yeah.
Yeah. It's natural in the former Yugoslav republics that you'd have something based on divide.
Very nice. But for my nomination, we are staying sort of in the Balkans, but we're going to a performance, like Chris talked about. So in 2003, the opera singer Tony Henry became known as the voice of Arsenal. Now, he's an extremely talented singer, and he got given that title because he sang Abide With Me, which is the traditional hymn that that's the traditional hymn that is sung at the start of the FA Cup final, and he absolutely nailed it. And so in 2007, he was invited to sing the anthems before England played Croatia at a crucial Euro 2008 qualifying match. He was also asked to sing the Croatian national anthem, Lijepa naša domovina. Now, there is a particular lyric in it, which is Mila kuda si planina, which is, my dear, how we love your mountains. He sang Mila kura si planina, which translates as, my dear, my penis is a mountain. at which point, the Croatian team absolutely lost their shit. It's quite something to see Luka Modric struggling to hide a snigger behind his skinny scarecrow hands. And the Croats apparently credit it with them going on to beat England 3-2 because they it's basically relaxed them, and so they played better. In fact, they liked it so much they invited him to come over and sing at Euro 2008 and asked if he would be their mascot. So for accidentally dropping a dick joke into a proud country's national anthem and for playing the part in knocking England out of Euro 2008, I am going to pick Tony Henry's rendition of the Croatian national anthem.
We've got Brutus and his pals from back in the old days when everything was made of stone.
Yeah.
And we've got Guy Fawkes. These both, for me, have an interesting resonance because these were people attempting to create something great in their own image. So you've got Guy Fawkes with a gang of blokes who were Catholics and went, we liked Elizabeth I. Turns out James I has a 10-year-old daughter called Elizabeth. She, in depictions, has ginger hair. We seem to be coming back to that theme quite a lot today. Yeah. And they went, well, let's kill James I, get rid of the parliament and reinstall Elizabeth as a Catholic queen. And so that's what they're trying to do. We all know the plot. We all know how it goes. They didn't drum up popular support. They just went straight for the jugular. What I think's amazing about this story, and I'm sure you know this already, but it is delightful, is that when he was caught under Parliament, rolling all the barrels in, they went, hey, you, what's your name? And he went, oh, John Johnson.
Yes.
he just, it's so sweet because sometimes little moments from history just make you totally understand what happened. And what happened there was he just panicked.
He was one step away from going Barry Barrelson.
Gunpowder plot, man. And they actually let him go that day. He went away, brought more barrels back, and then they found him again in the same place later that day. They were only looking because someone else had sent a guilt letter being like, oh, looks like things are going to get fiery in Parliament. And I'm like, blowing your way. And they were, okay, so they all kind of started to have a look around. Everybody had a conscience. Everyone really thought they were going to go to hell for it. John Johnson gets, weirdly, I thought he was burned at the stake. No, he was hung. Yeah. So I don't even know what's going on with that. And now
it's because in case there was any gunpowder still on him, they didn't want to explode.
It's not safe to bury the man.
Yeah.
Give us a very brief rundown for those who don't know what an RPG is, a role-playing game is.
Basically, it's collaborative storytelling where typically one person takes the role of narrator/referee. So they decide when the story is drifting out of things that could be reasonably narrated by anyone, you know, just around the table. For example, saying, I walk up to the bar, I open the door, I walk in and I start a conversation with the bartender. If you said, say, I open the door, I pull out a gun and I shoot the bartender in the head from the hip at 50 paces, not everyone can just do that as a matter of course, nor should they. So in this very specific example, the person fulfilling this role as narrator slash referee, sometimes referred to as the dungeon master or games master or, you know, what have you, they will ask you to roll, and then you'll have a character sheet with stats that will tell you, I'm this good at shooting, and then you roll and you see whether you hit or not. If you succeed, great, you've shot someone in the head in cold blood. If not, you've missed. Either way, the action advances, they explain the consequences, they set the scene again, and then everyone is free to act.
Lovely.
Great, great. So what we've asked Johnny to do is to run the world's shortest ever RPG. And we've given Johnny 5 minutes.
5 minutes, on the clock.
And they're going to run this game for the three of us. Okay. Off you go.
Right.
For the record.
Oh, we've got to get our dice out.
Okay, so what I'm going to need you to do is just find the 12-sided one.
Oh, no, that's the hardest one to find.
Yes, good. Is that right?
It's the hardest one to find. You've got a 1 in 7 chance that will accumulate as you go. You've nailed
got it.
Okay, is everyone ready?
Yes. Yep.
I'm going to hit go on this timer.
Yes.
Welcome to the exciting game of Adventure Bombs. This is a game in which you are all ordinary adventurers who have been cursed by a wizard. The wizard has turned you into walking, living, breathing bombs. In this game, you have one stat, and your stat is bomb. So basically, whenever you want to do something in this game that requires skill or more than just a random element of chance, I'm going to ask you to roll this die. If you roll 4 or above, then you succeed. So pretty good odds. If, however, at any point in this game, somebody rolls a 1, you explode, setting off a chain reaction that will wipe the party and end the game. I told you I could probably run this in under 5.
Yeah. This sounds like your modification to Monopoly again.
Yeah.
I am going quite explosives heavy, and I don't really know why, but...
One of us is a dog, one of us is a top hat, one of us is a boot.
We're going to get into character creation now. Okay. I need... this is sort of just imagine generic fantasy, like, think Tolkien, you're there, except for you're an explosive. For character creation, I need your name, your favourite weapon, and what type of explosive you are.
Okay.
My name, I'm going to go for my traditional D&D name, which is Osric Panhandle. And I am some TNT from the Acme Corporation.
Scratch that out.
What's the final thing?
Your favourite weapon.
My favourite weapon is Piers Morgan.
Okay, holding him by the ankles and swinging him around like a mace coated in blancmange. Okay. Barry?
I am Tim Keeper. I'm a time bomb.
I love it.
And my favourite weapon is my bare hands. Because I've got two of them. Because it's a clock thing.
Ellie?
Fuck, we had 1 minute, guys. Fuck yourselves.
Yeah, that's not enough time to think up something new. So I'm going to use the character I use. So sometimes I stream on Twitch and I stream erotic interactive fiction sometimes. And my character in that is called Rivita Bumface. So that...
Okay.
And she's a sexy nanny, so that's what we're going with. Secret weapon.
Sex bomb, I don't know.
Right. A very sharp knife.
Lovely. Yeah, perfect. All right. For those of you counting along at home, we're over halfway through our time. You are at the entrance to the wizard's tower. The wizard has cursed you to become bombs and wasn't expecting you to walk in the front door, frankly. So has sent some of his minions after you. There are some living skeletons kind of all clacking their way towards you. With little bone daggers in their hands. What are you all going to do?
I, with my fleshy hands, try and rip one of the daggers from their skeletal hands.
All right, make me a roll, please.
That's an 11.
You have done that. You have successfully wrested the dagger from the arm of the skeleton. The arm has come off entirely, in fact.
Oh, so
it's got quite a long range.
Yeah, nice.
Ben?
I am going to... grab Piers Morgan by the ankle.
Yeah, lovely.
I'm going to use him to sort of do a human pinata effect on the remaining skeletons.
Lovely, great.
I'm going to do what Rivita Bumface, the sexy nanny, would do, which is say, would you like me to put the children to bed or fix you a whiskey?
Make me a roll as well, please.
Okay.
I successfully rolled 11.
Amazing. So you sort of clothesline I'm going to say two of the three, so that just their legs are standing and the bones are just chattering on the floor. Nice. Like wind-up teeth. Ellie?
I've got four.
All right. That is also a success. The skulls just explode. This is so very steamy. Immediately, the wizard, emerging in like a gown with a nightcap on, sort of rubs his eyes and goes, "What is this? What is going on? Oh, it's those rubes. I turned into volatile explosives. Hello!"
A javelin, the skeleton arm with the knife in it, straight to the wizard's heart.
Make me a roll.
Yes! Already beloved character, Tim Keeper. One.
Okay. So the good news is you have defeated the wizard and you have purged his evil from the land. But in so doing, you have also destroyed yourselves.
Yes.
And basically, it would take the world's greatest forensics team to kind of separate all of you for a Cromunant burial. 2 minutes... No, 4 minutes, 56 seconds. Oh.
I was just about to get Piers Morgan to interview the wizard about how magic is becoming too woke these days.
Well, Piers Morgan has died.
Yes. Hooray!
Let's clip that and tweet it to him.